Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling disgraceful.
Oh, why is that?
And I'm, well, because you know me, I'm a total disgrace in public.
It's so true.
And I'm also feeling like a riotous force of nature.
Right.
That's a riotous force of nature, because today's guest is that. And I love her so much. She has brought so much joy to me. And I think that's actually a mission of hers. She's best known as a comedian, but she's also an actor, an author. She has an amazing book, which we'll mention later on. And she's on this kind of rebellious mission to kind of undermine most of the bullshit we are taught by society. That's actually a quote. And I underlined that because I think that's why I connect so much to her. We've never even met in real life, but we have spoken a lot online. And I think she's even coming to stay in Margate soon, because she recently has been doing stand-up in Margate. But I'm a massive fan of her, and I feel like we've had guests on before, like Self Esteem and like Lindsay Mendick and Katie Hessel, and there's this whole kind of generation of kind of modern day feminists, and I feel like today's guest is part of that kind of movement of very strong voices and just intelligent, glamorous, fiery, provocative, kind of all these amazing things. And I just feel this massive allyship with her, and I just wanted to have her on Talk Art, and here she is. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art the legendary Grace Campbell.
Oh, thanks,
hi Grace.
Guys, that was, oh, my dog, she always
like
does
dogs.
This the second I start recording anything, she starts barking. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. No,
you
it's
don't
fine
need to be sorry.
Bring her on.
We're like dog friendly. Russell's got,
yeah,
Rocky there.
Rocky's here just snoring at the minute. That's fine. Rocky's Grace snoring. Grace, bring the dog on.
We love the dog. Bring the dog on.
Don't apologise.
We love the dog.
Never apologise for dogs.
Okay, that's
dogs.
Good. She's just like, the second I start talking on anything, she gets annoyed and starts barking at like cats outside. Anyway, I've given her a duck chew.
Oh, that's cute. Can I clear something up, right? Rob's just said, described you as a comedian. Would you use the term comedienne?
No.
Would you use the term actress or actor?
I would probably maybe say actress, because I hear that said quite a lot, whereas I don't really hear comedian said much. But I don't really mind. I keep, because of that post office like scandal, I keep hearing the word postmistress, and I don't know why, but I've never heard that word before, and I'm like, I can't believe that's like a title that people have.
Postmistresses.
Yeah, my dad the other day was talking about this postmistress that's running against the Labour MP. I was like, lol.
So comedian, no. Actress, fine.
Well, yeah. I described you as an actor, so.
No, that's what I mean, but there's.
And I would also say actor.
Right, but there is a thing.
Thanks, Russ. So I think what we've learned here is I was right in the intro. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, no. I just, because I'm starting to have this thing where I second guess myself now when I talk about a fellow actress or actor who's female.
Yeah.
I go, am I saying the right thing now? Am I catching up with what is appropriate?
Maybe that's good though, because it shows you care, babe.
I've always cared.
You're being thoughtful.
I've always.
Yeah, and I also, it's I think probably some people would say I should say, it's like I get so much, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, we love swear
words. I get so much shit for saying vagina because people always call me out because they're like, it's a vulva. And I'm like, unfortunately, I've spent my whole life referring to my own vagina as vagina and I'm not, it's mine. Like, I can call it whatever I want to call it. And like, I'm not that bothered about that, but like some people are. And I think some people are bothered about actor and actress, but I like personally, I'm not.
Do you think vagina and vulva is kind of the same conversation as actor and actress?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think.
I was also correct in the intro.
And postmistress.
It's all the same thing.
I was correct in the intro when I said provocative as well.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
Grace.
Yeah.
You were born in 1994. You live in Northwest London. Did you grow up with art? Was art a part of your childhood?
Okay, I have a really weird relationship with art. Like I grew up going to the V&A. That was like where I have a lot of memories. Me and my mum would always go to the V&A around Christmas time. I definitely did grow up around art because I grew up around like artists and like various. Well, okay, when I was at secondary school, I went to like the local like comprehensive school near where I live in Camden. And I was really badly behaved at school. Like, I was really badly behaved. And I loved art because it was, like, the class where I could be badly behaved, basically. Like, I loved it. And I was probably quite badly behaved in art class. And then when we were picking our GCSEs, I was going to pick art GCSE, mainly for that reason, because I was like, oh, I can, like, talk loads. And then the teacher told me, I probably shouldn't say this. My mum will hate that I'm saying this because it's like makes my school sound bad and like we should big up state schools. But my teacher said if I did art GCSE, she would refuse to teach me because I was so unskilled at art, right? So then I didn't pick it. I picked like RE or something really weird. And then I had this aversion to art because I was like, oh, well, I'm not artistic. And I felt really like, I felt like I wasn't a creative person. When actually, obviously, I was because of what I've ended up doing now. Then I went to art school, technically. I went to LCC, which is like it was a London School of Printing, part of UAL. And I did a filmmaking degree there for university. But again, then I felt really like, oh my God, but I can't say like I'm like a creative or like creative person because I'm not. Like I'm like, I always thought I was like, how do I describe this? I always felt like slightly left out of it and also like I wasn't creative. Now I know that I am. So to answer your question, Russell, I grew up around art, definitely, but I also grew up thinking that it wasn't like for me and it wasn't like my thing. And I also grew up not really understanding what it was in loads of ways.
That's such bad form on that teacher's front. I mean, all art is subjective. So unskilled when it comes to maybe academically what needs to be marked for an exam, but actually unskilled as an artist overall is bullshit. I mean, what were you doing? What were you making?
Crazy to say that.
It was unbelievable.
14-year-old.
Unbelievable. It's so, and it actually closed you down. It didn't open you up. What she did, them words, actually made you have your self-worth as a creative person was dimmed.
Yeah, and it's weird because like I now like because always deep down I've wanted to make films and that is what I'm sort of finally now like I've gone like a really long loop of finally getting to the point where I'm directing stuff, and I used to think but I would never be able to be good at that because I'm not a creative person, I'm not like a visual person, like I always thought. Like, I just never thought I was good at that, basically. And now I know that I am. And I also feel like it's such a way that, like, people, especially, I think, women, are, like, made to feel like they're not going to be good at doing something in a way to, like, prevent them from actually, you know, doing something in their own way.
What was you seeing at the V&A when you was going with your mum at Christmas? And why was it Christmas? It was just, like, a tradition.
It was a tradition. We'd always go at Christmas and I just loved looking at like really crazy costumes and like old corsets. And I love clothes. I love looking at clothes. I love looking at I still love going to see stuff there when they've got really amazing clothes in. But again, I have a really weird relationship. I have a weird relationship with galleries. They make me very anxious.
Really?
Because...
Yeah. Because I have always been told that I'm too loud and I don't have a very good sense of volume, which is definitely true. Like, I get told off every cinema that I'm in. I get asked to, like, shut up because I can't work out. I think I'm whispering and I'm not. And so I always find the quietness in galleries. I feel really stressed because I feel like if I speak, I'm going to have ruined their moment and they're going to look at me like, why the fuck is she here? But I love appreciating art. I just find some galleries kind of trigger me into like panic attacks.
Do you think this is a thing that you're going to look back on in 10 years? Because now you've said that you've looped into being a director and believing that you have a creative energy when it comes to visually directing something. Do you feel like in 10 years, if we revisit you, you're going to say, I now go to galleries all the time. I feel like I can talk in a gallery. I feel like agency to be in there.
Maybe. I think I'm at the beginning. I'm really good friends with Katie Hessel and we have this ongoing joke because she's like, you know, we were in New York together last April and she'd be like, okay, we're going today. We're going to go to MoMA and then we're going to go to the Met. And I'd be like, unfortunately, I'm not going to come. Like, I'll have to meet you afterwards because I just know I'll ruin it for you guys because like, I'll just be stressed. It's too bright. I don't like really busy places. I have really bad anxiety. So like certain sort of like places where I feel like I'm a bit out of control, like sometimes I get, anyway. So I'm trying to work on that because as I am becoming more like aware of art and my own personal style, I want to, you know, feel like I can like back myself into going to those places and being like, yeah, like I get it. But I've always felt a little bit like, I don't know.
I think it's a universal feeling. I don't think that is just personal to you. I think many, many people don't feel they have permission to go to these places. And that's the whole point why we started this podcast, is for people like yourself to listen and go, oh, it is for me. This isn't just like, I don't need to know everything before I walk in the door. I haven't got to like everything. I just need to walk in the door and know that the artists want me there. Whatever fortress is built around the art that's in it, that's whatever the artist is doing, they want to communicate with me.
It's interesting, that idea as well of the noise side of it and how you feel like you can't just be yourself in that space because it's so like hallowed and kind of silenced and muted or whatever. But I think these days there's so much art that's coming through which is really participatory and which allows you to like maybe like go down a slide. Do you know what I mean? And like,
yeah.
And joy. Like there's this new movement for joy in art where people are actually allowed to talk and participate and, you know, walk through, I don't know, like a cloudy room of mist which changes colour as you walk through it, you know. Like the Welcome Collection had that artist, Anna Veronica Janssens, I think her name is, who did that. You know, so I think in a way, museums and galleries need to think about that and think about ways that they can bring people in a kind of joyous, collaborative, you know, way that you feel like you're welcome.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I got my best friend a membership to the Tate for Christmas and we're going to go there like this year and she's going to tell me things that we can sort of like go to together. And I think it's about me just remembering that like obviously those places can be fun. I've just always, it's a bit like, I remember when I was with my ex-boyfriend like loved art and loved whenever we'd go on holiday, like we'd go to different galleries and exhibitions and stuff. And I remember we were in Berlin and we were so hungover. I was like, the last thing I can imagine doing right now is walking around and looking at stuff. So we go, yeah. I don't know where we were in this gallery. And I was like, I'm just going to go and sit down. And I fell asleep on this bench in the middle.
In the middle?
In the middle, yeah. In the middle. And he like, I woke up and he was hovering over me like, what the fuck are you doing? But I remember that one being like particularly like bright. It was really bright and it was really like quiet. And I remember thinking, and I'd try and talk to him and he'd be like, shh. And then I'd be like, I can't even talk to my fucking boyfriend.
Getting shushed. Getting shushed by your boyfriend. Oh, God. So you said you knew artists. You're like, I said, did you grow up with art? But you said you knew artists, or did you know artists growing up? Did you have like family, well, like, friends? And
We had not like that. I grew up around a lot of filmmakers and photographers and just like, I guess, people that my mum and dad were friends with. And then I remember actually, so my dad, this is such like name drop, but my dad did this thing for Comic Relief where he did like a celebrity version of The Apprentice. And Tracy Emin like gave these coconuts that she'd painted as boobs, like for the one, it was one of the sort of like, it was a fairground. They had to do a fairground and they all had different things. And she'd given like eight or something. And I was like 11 years old. I did it. I think it was like when one of those things where you throw a hoop on something and then you win a prize, you know, like at a fun
fair. Like coconut anyway, shark. Oh, no, not.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, yeah. And so then I won one when I was 11, or I could choose a teddy bear. I was 11. Like, it's so embarrassing, this story, because I was older than teddy bear age, but I chose the teddy bear.
Oh, for an original Tracy Emin.
And my dad never, ever lets me forget it, because he got one. So he's got one and he loves to talk about it.
Do you wish you had one now, or do you, have you still got the teddy bear?
100%, because also it was a boob. Like, that is just, like, such a vibe.
Do you think doing stand-up, comedy itself, is performance art?
Yes, I do, yes. And I think that maybe we as stand-ups don't necessarily think about that much, you know? Like, I've had a really interesting shift in the last... I would say it started in like 2022, in the summer of 2022, where I realized that my stand up, and when I'm live especially, it's quite raw, and sometimes I say things that probably, you know, like when you've had like a big night out and you wake up like, oh my god, I can't believe I told that person that I've like never met, that really personal story about myself. That's how I feel after shows. Like, I just say stuff, like, and I'm like, why did I say that?
So it's quite a lot of improv involved in what you do.
Some of it, yeah, because I talk to the audience a lot. So then if they say something right. that sort of triggers a memory of mine, then I'll tell a story, and then I'll be like, oh, I shouldn't be telling. And as I'm saying it, I'm like, I shouldn't really be telling this story, but I guess I'll tell it. Please don't tell anyone.
400 people, whatever, yeah.
This stays in this room.
Yeah.
But I've realised recently that I just sort of on the like performance art that I think I need to have better boundaries with like my relationship with my stand-up persona, because I don't think I've quite realized that it is a persona. It is a something that I've created. It isn't me entirely, and I think I need to have healthier boundaries with that, so that I don't always have that feeling of like I'm oversharing, and then I feel a bit too vulnerable, and then I feel worried that like it makes me feel like a bit overexposed. And so I think one of the things I'm working on before my next show is like, I'm going to really work on directing myself into actually making it, leveraging it into being much more like a work of like performance art than just me standing on a stage telling you too much information about myself. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, what would make it performance art then, rather than a routine?
I think, well, I'm going to be a lot more physical now. So I think one of the things I'm sort of studying, and I'm going to see various different shows at the moment, is thinking about how I can use my body, which I already do subconsciously, but how I can really lean into ways that I use my body and ways that I use lights as well. I think I've been so bog standard so far, and this next show that I'm writing, I want people to take it much more seriously, because I think so far in my career people have been a bit like, oh, who's this like Nepo baby who just swears quite a lot and talks about her vagina.
Your vulva. Please, if we're going to talk about it, the vulva. Thank you.
It's interesting, this idea of that vulnerability of when you're being so open and almost like unexpectedly so. I've heard that a lot with artists that I work with. And there's an artist who lives in Margate, actually, called Lindsay Mendick. And Lindsay did a performance last summer in Edinburgh at Jupiter Artland. She had a big exhibition there. But in the summer, they have this festival thing. And she did this performance called A Pound of Flesh. And she dressed up as a pig in kind of like latex pink, you know, almost like S&M gear, but with a pig's head kind of mask thing. And then she collaborated with two colleagues of hers who were performance artists and dancers, also from Margate, Tolu, and I can't remember who else did it with them, but anyway, there were like three or four of them doing it. And they actually made sausages like live in front of this audience, and they created this kind of like this hay, you know, like a farm kind of stable thing that they were in the middle of. And she was making sausages and then screaming at the audience going like, are you happy now? And she did this whole kind of monologue, which, wow, I can't remember where it's from. It might have been from Gladiator. It was from like some film, I think. And she restaged this kind of monologue, and it was so disturbing. And it was all based on this idea that like her work is autobiographical, just like yours is. And that was weirdly when I started seeing what you were doing as art, in a way, because, and I think you're really part of this movement of artists at the moment who are using their kind of, or sharing their life stories really in a vulnerable, deep, like it's almost like cutting yourself or something and bleeding, you know, for an audience. And then the audience gets more and more demanding. And it's such a high expectation. And like you were describing in the intro, you said you're anxious. Like loads of the artists I know, even myself, like I think we all feel anxious on this public stage. But it's such a weird thing that we are attracted to it. You know, we keep putting ourselves back there.
It's almost like, I don't know, basically, when I realized all of this, I'd written this article in The Guardian about being raped, and I was really shocked at how widely it was received. I knew people would read it, but I didn't really understand. Like, I got like just under 10,000 DMs on Instagram in like a day, like in the day that it came out. And it was after that, and because then, this sounds really bad, but then I felt there was an expectation of me to talk to people about that and that topic when I was just out and about, like, living my life. And that really, really ground me down. Is that...
Yeah,
really did start to wear me down, because I could just see it wasn't a sustainable way to live the rest of my life, to be someone who, like, I still want to do that and I still want to talk about these things. And actually my next show is about something really traumatic, but I think I need to have kind of why I'm saying about maybe making the show a bit more of a spectacle, so that then people are relating to it, but they're not thinking this is exactly her, so that then if I meet her, I can talk to her as frankly as I want to, because that's the part. This sounds really ungrateful, like what I'm saying, and I kind of hate saying it out loud because it sounds like I don't appreciate like people saying that stuff. I've just got to have a bit more of a healthier relationship with it, because sometimes I'll be like, yeah, exactly.
You know, like I did a podcast called Griefcast where I spoke about my brother's death. And A, after doing it, I was quite traumatized for about 3 weeks because I sort of PTSD'd myself by having literally spoken about it. And then it was the first time that I would get on the train and then people would recognize my voice and literally cry on me and tell me about their losses and stuff. And it's a lot to take on. But equally, we were in New York the other week in November for Tracy Emin's opening. And I was with Shirley Manson from Garbage. And this woman came up to her and then somebody came up to me. And Shirley said to me, she goes, it's really interesting. They're coming to you now, you know, about the podcast or whatever. And what they talk about is never actually the podcast. It's their own experiences. And she said that she'd learned that through being Garbage, that actually what you're doing is you're helping people come to terms with their own traumas in a way. And that's an amazing like privilege and gift in a way. But it's equally, you have to try and protect yourself because you can't just take on the world's trauma on top of your own trauma. You know what I mean? It's not productive really in the end. Like, yeah, you can't keep going.
No, I think that's the thing. I realized at some point in the last 18 months that it was affecting my sort of mood so much that it was affecting the people around me. And I was like, I don't want to affect them because they're the people who are like looking after me and making sure I'm okay. So I think for the sake of them, I'm just going to have like healthy boundaries. But I will always, always talk about these things because it's just who I am. Like, I will meet someone and within 5 minutes of meeting them, if I think they're nice, I'll tell them the deepest, darkest things that have ever happened to me if we're having that kind of conversation. Yeah. That's not going to change.
No.
I think it's just about being able to sort of like know when I'm not in a place where I want to just talk to a random person about their experience with rape or, you know, any kind of physical trauma.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I think that's the journey of an artist. I think that's creativity. I think you work out how much of yourself you want to give up or give away or allow people in. And I mean, we talk to other performance artists like Marina Abramovic, for example, when she has that piece where there's all those implements lined up on a table. I don't know if you know this piece, and I think there's 37 pieces and people were invited to pick something up and basically do whatever they wanted to do to her body. And by the end of this performance, people had cut her, people had like a loaded gun up against her head, and she'd like basically had like a mini breakdown afterwards, but she put herself out there to rumble.
I'm not surprised.
And she would never repeat
it. Didn't someone pick the gun up and throw it out the window or something?
I don't know.
I think there's some.
And then Yoko Ono did it and she sat there, and then people would come up and just like, they were allowed to do what they want, and they were like cutting around her breast and revealing her, pulling her breast out, and women and men were doing it. As artists, it's basically revealing humanity in that moment, what we're all actually capable of. But I think as artists, you do push yourself to the limit and then you wind yourself back. And I guess at this point, Grace, you know, you're 30 now, you've probably gone, okay, and you're getting a lot of exposure and you're becoming really successful and well-known. For like now, you're probably doing the cha-cha-cha with stuff, pushing it and then taking it back a bit. You know, that's all you can do as artists. and you want to tell your story. You want
to share.
It's also
going to change the way you make your work, which is great, because you'll develop and it's not always the same thing. Like, you're evolving, and that's what you should do as an artist.
Yeah, and I think, like, what's really cool about stand-up is that most of it is not, it's not immortalized, you know? Like, the most of my stand-up, thank God, just happened live. So, like, those shows that I've done have been incredible, and I'm so glad that I've, like, shared all these moments. But I look back on some of my, like, earlier stand-up and think, A, like, I can't believe I thought some of the things I was saying were, like, of a high caliber, but I guess it was just the beginning of my career. And B, thank God it wasn't televised, because I'm just getting better and better, and I can see that, and I can see, like, my style evolving. And this is what happens, like, once you, like, start harnessing something. And then I'm like, I don't really want to have something really big happen in my career until I know that I'm really ready for that, and that I feel, like, really in control of it.
When do you think that will be? Do you feel?
I think it is happening at the moment. I think I've had such a, I feel like I've grown up so much in the last year, and I've sort of changed entirely how I sort of value myself and treat myself and make sure other people treat me. And I've really sort of developed such a healthier relationship with, like, other people and myself. So I think now I'm getting to a place where everything feels really rich to me. I feel like I'm learning so much, everything that I do. And the years I've been doing stand-up have sort of helped me really see kind of what I want my style to be. And now I want to move into, like, making films and immortalizing some of the things I want to say in a different way.
Are these personal films you're making?
Yeah, quite. A script that I'm writing at the moment is really very personal and pretty dark, but also funny.
What filmmakers are you looking at? What are your references?
There's so many different things, you know, like, one of the, like, I loved Boiling Point. Like, I watched that again and again.
So you do want to do one takes? Would you like the idea of one take?
I think for a first time feature film director, I'm not going to try and do that. But that kind of intensity of, like, a nervous breakdown. And then I watch Girls whenever I want to, like, remind myself of, like, you know, Girls inspires me so much. I don't know, like, I watch a lot of TV, like, Succession, The Thick of It, Veep, a lot of my, like, comedy references. Oh my God, have you seen Poor Things?
Yeah.
No, but we've... Oh, you've seen
it? Do you love
it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
I loved it. Did you love it?
Yes, to a certain extent, yes. I struggled. It was hard going at the beginning. I was like, this is... I love everybody in it and the choices he was making, and the direction obviously is phenomenal, and it's bizarre, it's kooky as fuck. But then I was like, this is a bit of a slog. And then it turned.
Yeah, and everybody said... I'd been warned by a few people, like, just get through the first half an hour.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, because one of our mates, Holly, actually messaged, didn't she, in our group chat the other day and said, has anyone seen it? Because her partner didn't like it at all. Yeah. And she wanted to have, like, a big discussion with all of us, but not all of us have seen it yet. God, that's really interesting. I can't wait to see it.
It is really interesting. And I had, weirdly, I was getting acupuncture today, and my acupuncturist was saying that he maybe felt it was too much in the male gaze, and, like, a lot of the sort of, I don't want to give too much away, but, like, a lot of the sex stuff was, like, way too much in the perspective of a man. But, like, weirdly, I didn't necessarily feel that. I was like, God, I said to my dad, do not watch this film. Like, it's a lot. The sex is a lot. But I just think Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo together, we are lucky to be able to, like, have that in the world.
So Yorgos Lanthimos, does he inspire you as a director, potentially?
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, like, but he's so ambitious, and also he's had, like, an amazing career and has, like, developed, like, his style has only, like, developed more and more. But yeah, Greta Gerwig, like, I've been following her since I was at uni, like, nearly 10 years ago, and she's a good example of, like, her trajectory has been, like, quite similar. And then another person is Sharon Horgan.
I just admire
her so much. And love the fact that she just tells these, like, amazing stories about women over and over again.
What amazing time that you can actually name all these women. You know, we might have spoke a few years back and you wouldn't be naming, you know, the most like, successful female director in the history of, you know, Hollywood. You know, as happened in the last, like, year with Barbie. It's like this is a really exciting time that you're able to name so many amazing women that are inspiring you.
I'm also really happy you mentioned Girls, because Lena Dunham, for me, is just one of the greats. And I'm so happy she's back, like, writing, producing, making, directing. Do you know what I mean? Acting.
Painting.
I think she's in a thing with Stephen Fry, isn't she, Russ?
Yeah, about
a Jewish story. Like, amazing that she's, I don't know, I just think all power to her. I love Lena
Dunham.
But
also she got so much shit. And she was 24 when she made the first season of Girls, a lot of which she directed. 24. That is unbelievable. When you watch it now, I'm like, because I'm older than that now, I'm like, some of the stuff that she's saying in terms of like mental health and relationships, like, stand like so strongly now. And I'm like, how was she saying this then? Like, yeah, I love her so much.
And she's someone that's really evolved as well. And I think has like taken on board, if she said something wrong, she's actually like learnt, put the work in, developed, grown. And she's just, I think she's an artist actually. And she grew up with artist parents like Laurie Simmons and Tip Dunham, Carol Dunham.
Well, I loved her film, Tiny Furniture. I used to be obsessed with that film.
That was made with her mum, wasn't it? Like, or her mum's sex.
Her mum and, yeah. Her mum plays her mum and her, yeah, I loved that film.
So, Grace, something I mentioned in the introduction was obviously disgraceful, and that you actually ran a club in London for LGBT and women comics to have a space to grow, to experiment, to try things out. And it was really successful. And I really, really liked the fact that from a really early point in your career, you've been sharing the stage and trying to like collaborate and pioneer new voices and people that might not necessarily have had a space yet. Can you talk a bit about
comedy
that?
Comedy is like live comedy is just so, it still is very male run and very gatekeepy. And actually I had to do like a lot of that at the beginning, but then once I didn't, I was like, one of the things I do at the Disgraceful Club is I like people who have like either never done a gig before or are like very new to stand up. I always have one person who's like kind of really fresh to it so that they can have like a good first gig experience, because some of the stories that you hear, and like my first like 15 gigs were just horrific. I'd be like the only girl on the lineup. All of the men would just stand there like sort of glaring at me if anybody laughed at my jokes, and no one would say anything nice to me when I came off stage. Luckily, I have like really good friends who came to every single show that I ever did. But so I wanted to do something like that. And also the nights are just really non-judgmental. Again, like when I go and do like some gigs, because I talk so much about sex, I'll get like a lot of kind of like from people in the audience, and that is just so jarring. And so I think the vibe of these nights are like, just come and talk about whatever the fuck you want to talk about, and like it doesn't have to be polished, you can just try stuff. And I film their sets and then give them the footage so they can post it online. But they're so fun, they are like the funnest nights ever. And just my thing is, I just want lots of friends in comedy, and we have like an alliance where we all like have each other's backs. That was the goal.
Giving each other like a critique, like you were saying, no one really talked to you afterwards, and you're giving this space to people. To have a comedy critique with your peers, is that helpful? Or is it?
It's so helpful. It's so helpful. I've got like three really good friends who are comics, and when we gig together, we'll like watch each other's sets and be like, "You, why don't you say this?" And then it's like they'll have just watched something and given you like a really like priceless bit of advice, and then you're like, "Oh my god, thank fuck you were here." So yeah, it's really nice. It's really nice.
What don't you say?
Because comedy can be quite isolating, because you are literally on your own on a stage. You're not in a band. Like it's just you.
Yeah. What don't you say to a comic?
What don't you say to a comic? Tell me a joke. I hate that. People, like a lot of people sort of, when I started doing stand-up, people used to be like, well, you're only doing well because you have a dad that you can talk about. And I was like, okay, well, fair play. I used to get a lot of that. I actually got a lot of people really didn't like me when I started doing stand-up because of that, which is, you know, fair enough. That's their right.
Didn't they say to you, all you'll ever be is the daughter of Alistair Campbell?
Yeah, I had so many people after a really good set, I'd come off stage and they'd be like, yeah, well, you are lucky, you know, because you've got something really interesting to talk about. And it's like, Yeah, I do, but that is also my life. Like, it's my life. You're all talking about your lives, and like that was one part of my life, was growing up with my dad being who he was.
Yeah, but also I feel really strongly that you've got so much fucking charisma and personality that is yours. And you are
totally,
you.
Yeah.
And you are sharing your life, which is not always about Alistair Campbell. Do you know what I mean? I know you've done stuff with your dad, like collaborated with him and stuff on TV. And
no, it's a classic. It's just a classic.
It's such a misogynistic thing. It's like so boring.
It's so classic. And actually my comebacks now are so good because that is what I say. I say, I don't think you would say that to a man. And it is deeply sexist to resort someone to who their father is. That's like we're living in the fucking, you know, women have to be virgins before they get married era. If you think you can do that. So when I've had that, because I have it all the time, like, you know, people will still like scream at me from audiences. And I'm just like, I'm A, not even talking about it when that happens. But B, you're making yourself look worse right now by doing that. It's not a good look to like shout at a young woman because of who her dad is.
Did you ever go into Downing Street when you were a kid?
Yes.
What was the art like?
Terrible art.
Really, that's what I want to ask about. Because there is the government, it's the government art collection. And every, like the presidents can choose art that they live with in the White House. Prime ministers can choose work from the collection of the government art collection that they can live with.
Can they? That's mad. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. So when they move in, they can say like what they kind of want to bring in.
They can choose from what's available.
But also, Tracy Emin asked to have hers removed, didn't she?
Yes.
She had a neon in number 10.
More passion.
And then she was so pissed off with the government. I think it was during COVID, wasn't it? And she was so angry with them that she asked it to be moved. And I think it was sent to France to like an embassy.
Yeah, it was.
Wow. So she actually got it removed, which you don't always have the control for.
What do you remember the art being like?
I can't remember. I'm so sorry to disappoint. I wish I could. I conflate my memories of Downing Street with that scene in Love Actually where Hugh Grant's like running through the corridors.
Martin McCutcheon's there. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember which is my real memories and Love Actually.
It's the same thing. Oh, it's based on this documentary, isn't it?
But talking about politics, it has sort of infused
Eddie?
Into Eddie. Is your dog
my dad,
Eddie?
Yeah, after Edina Monsoon.
I was going to say.
Yeah, my dad fabulous. Got me a bust of Eddie's head for Christmas. Do you
really?
Want me to show you?
Yeah. And you're going to have to.
She's barking at it.
You're going
right
to have to send us a picture as well that we can put on social media because it's frustrating
God, so
for
good.
People.
But
they
she's
can't
barking
see.
Right now because she thinks it's a real dog. And so she's trying
oh,
to.
Oh, you put it next to her, do you, this bust?
Yeah, let us show you.
Okay. Is it not on a shelf?
We need to get wrong.
in the dog's bed with her. Oh.
Ooh. One sec. It's so heavy. Ooh. Let me just put it down.
What a beautiful object.
Sorry, I can't hear you. What did
I said,
you say?
What a beautiful object.
It's like a weapon.
So is it actually your dog or is it a similar looking dog?
No, it's my dog.
How did they plaster cast her head? How did they do
Let
it?
Let me show you my dog. He had someone come and hang out with her loads when I was away.
Oh,
come here. Come here.
So your dad got you an artwork for Christmas. And is it bronze?
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you love it?
Yeah, it looks bronze.
I do love it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah. Anyway, I was trying to say that because you'd grown up in quite a political family, it's probably like infused within your soul, you know, the idea of politics. And I was really impressed by the Pink Protest and you and a group of friends, including actually an artist, an illustrator, Alice Skinner.
Yes, Alice Skinner, who did Scarlett book covers and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And Scarlett Curtis. Can you talk a bit about that? Because you actually changed the law.
Yes,
the four of you.
It was the part of a legislation. So this was so, it's so weird thinking about that time, which wasn't very long ago, but it was so different in terms of how we spoke about things. So it was like still when like period blood was blue in like tampon adverts, not that long ago.
Yeah, it
was sort of very shameful still to talk like publicly about being on your period. Kind of when I started doing stand-up, and I was shocked at how like taboo certain things that I was talking about were. We met this girl called Amica George, who was a schoolgirl who had basically like wanted to abolish the tampon tax. And then what we helped her with, she's now fighting a water bottle.
Not her bust. What...
Well, Eddie is a big humper. It's a real problem. And so she's I can't have men round when she's like humping stuff. Sorry, that's a completely change of topic. What was I talking about?
We were talking about, the period tax.
So... Tampon tax.
Tampon tax.
Oh my god, sorry, my headphones just
did something.
Eddie,
you're...
This dog.
It's actually like the Absolutely Fabulous character.
Eddie.
I'm really sorry.
That's all right.
We were just saying your dog is actually like the Absolutely Fabulous character. Very demanding for attention.
She really is. And also, the toys that she humps are a Moe bottle toy that I got her.
Of course.
Like a champagne bottle. And then this Louis Vuitton bag that I got her called Chewy Vuitton.
Oh, yes. I used to have one of those for Rocky. Very bougie.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, guys. This is the last thing I'm going to do. I'm just going to take the next one.
Okay.
Okay, she's gone. She's gone.
Okay.
I feel a bit sad now. I miss her.
No, she's really annoying. So what we did is we organised a protest, and it was so cool. It was like all these like... schoolgirls came from school and had made all these like banners and stuff, and then we ended up changing the law so that the tampon tax money was given to funding like free tampons and pads basically for kids in the UK.
Great.
But that's epic. That's such a big change.
Because before that they were seen as luxury items, right?
Which is crazy. Yeah. And men's razors weren't, and Viagra wasn't.
Viagra
was seen as a like, you know, necessity, and tampons and pads and stuff were seen as luxury goods.
And also the hashtag free periods became a really big thing, didn't it? And it's kind of united a lot of people around the world. So it's an amazing, well done.
So when it comes to the commercials, just to jump in. So it was blue. Yes. I remember the blue for simulating period.
Ooh.
Is it red now then?
Yeah.
When did that all change?
Around that time, that was one of the other sort of things that, and that wasn't us, but that was one of the things that happened in that moment. There were two things that happened, was that suddenly everyone was talking about periods and suddenly everyone was talking about wanking. And I remember that really well because like I started talking about wanking online a lot and it got a lot of attention. Because, and then we did this other thing that was Girls Wank Too, was our other like on side to free periods. Our other thing was about wanking, and we would get loads of women to like tell their stories about masturbation and how they'd felt really ashamed their whole lives because they didn't know that like it was okay to talk about it. And you know, my big thing is like the more we speak about this stuff, the healthier our relationships with sex would be, and then we would probably avoid like really bad things happening to us in our adolescence if we just like knew more about our bodies. Mm-hmm. And it's just all changed so much that now everybody talks about wanking. Like it's so funny how quickly these things can change, and then you look back and you're like, god, that's crazy, not even that long ago it was quite different.
I remember this scene in I May Destroy You, and this is when I thought, you know, some people say that storytelling is, you might have reached a limit of how many stories you can tell of what it is to be a human being. And there was a scene in I May Destroy You where she has a one-night stand with this guy, I think it's a one-night stand, and she's on her period, and he pulls out the tampon, and then they're talking about it, and then they're like, he's like, what's that? And she said, it's clotting, and he sort of plays with it in his hand. And I remember thinking, isn't this incredible that this is seen as so cutting edge? This has never been seen before. I've never seen any conversations like this ever in art, in film, TV. And this is 2023 or 2022 when they come out. And this is seen as really controversial and shocking. And yet half the planet does this every month. And
and also scenes like that help people feel so much
completely.
More normal. It's like in moments like watching that, you'd be like, oh God. So like, because, you know, like again, like one of the things I talk about a lot in stand-up is like a lot of like straight men are so shaming about periods and will be like, I'm not coming anywhere near you when you're... on your period, and that makes you then feel more disgusting. So something like that is like, yeah, that's obviously how it should be. Like it should just be completely normal to talk to someone you're having sex with about like what's going on in your body.
Yeah, I mean, Tampax are not funny, period.
Oh my God, Russell. That was also why I love Tracy Emin so much. That was also why I love Tracy Emin so much. There was a really amazing, obviously she had tampons in the, I think in the bed display that was in the Turner Prize, but there was a really amazing work she made called The History of Painting, which I think in the medium, you know, of it, there's like ink on paper, like, you know, she's done a letter, but I think it has like pregnancy tests, box of morning after pills, tampons, blood and tissue paper. So it was in these vitrines. And I remember that work feeling so like radical. Yeah, it's from radical. Like 99.
But that was that was really radical.
Yeah, but really... at the time she was slagged off for it, like completely shut down for it. And it's really interesting that it's taken that long to get to I May Destroy You, you know.
Yeah,
and also,
I know.
There's artists in the feminist movement before. Like, we just interviewed Judy Chicago, who's, you know, in her 80s now. We fucking love her.
She's
and
amazing.
We finally interviewed
her. So you know her. The work of Judy Chicago? Judy.
Yeah, I actually went to I was just in New York in November, and my friend Dan was like, come with, and I went. I really liked that, and I had a
At
really
the New Museum?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Her story on the Bowery.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you respond to it so well?
Oh, my God.
I don't know. Like, I didn't really know much about her. I really didn't. Like, I'm quite stupid when it comes to art. And I just thought there was, I loved her whole vibe. I think she would be someone that, like, I would love to hang out with. I loved all her, like, trippy shit. I love her vagina plates as well. My friend was showing me them.
They're so good.
So vulva.
Yeah, sorry, please.
I also
please,
just...
Sorry, Russell, I can see you grimacing.
I was just like, I can't keep saying vagina.
No, once is enough, yeah.
I love her collaboration with Pussy Riot as well, and like how she's constantly trying to collaborate with other women and like, you know, help platform different people. It's just, she's fucking amazing.
But again, like, she was such a pioneer, and there are so many women like that. And I think about that, like, I wrote my dissertation at university about Mae West, who was like, she was a comedian in the 1930s, and she was completely disgraced and banished because she spoke about sex in her comedy, and she was treated like a criminal. And there have been so many iconic women who have been doing this for such a long time, so that now we can just like talk about wanking on Instagram. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and talk art.
It's all thanks to them.
Yeah. I love Mae West's quote, "I used to be Snow White, but I drifted."
Yeah, I love that
genius,
quote.
Isn't it?
She's one of my like style icons as well. I love the way that she dressed.
Did you know,
oh, so iconic,
Grace, that you have an art gallery named after you?
As in my full name?
The Grace Campbell Art Gallery in Saskatchewan in Canada. Now, I'm going to read
really?
This. I just looked it up. And just tell me if this is you. Grace Campbell served as public and regional librarian in Prince Albert from 1955 to 1973. I don't know if that is you.
That was me. I was so busy then.
Born in Scotland, Grace obtained her library science degree from McGill University and worked as a librarian in Prince Edward Island for many years, encouraged by her friend Marion Gilroy. Are you still friends with Marion?
Yeah, no, Marion's dead now.
Oh, okay.
She died.
Grace migrated to Prince Albert in 1950. During her tenure, Grace advanced the library's presence in a community and oversaw the expansion, of the regional library and the design of the John M. Kulinara Public Library. You retired to Victoria, British Columbia in 1973, a few weeks before the grand opening of the library. The library's art gallery was named in your honour.
Well done.
Wow, I know, thank you.
That's amazing you achieved.
That is amazing.
It's a shame your friend's dead, though. She sounds like a right laugh.
That's so cool. Is she / me, is she still alive, does it say?
She says she retired in 1973.
Right.
So unless
we need a reunion.
Unless she retired when she was 20.
She's probably broken lots of records. She's still alive.
She might retire when she was a teenager. Yeah. I don't know, but she would still be it.
I love her. The thing is, that was it makes sense it's you, Grace, because the 70s is obviously a really important time for feminism. I was actually watching a video on Instagram this morning of Shia Hight.
Oh, the documentary. The
sex educator, yeah. And she, in the 70s, she went on TV and spoke about masturbation and basically said that, like, all women masturbate before they have sex, say, with a man, and then they can make themselves come, or orgasm, sorry.
right, Rob.
No, either's fine, Robert. Either's
all right,
fine.
Rob.
I'm just trying to be polite.
Jesus.
Fuck.
Fucking hell.
Anyway, she said it on TV.
She said it on TV and she was vilified.
Your mom listens to this. Make themselves calm. Oh, sorry.
Anyway.
Orgasm.
Pardon me, orgasm.
At the time, it was like... totally shocking.
Pardon me.
Oh, my God. Anyway, I love her. I think she's amazing.
I love her. I went to see that documentary when I was in New York.
Who are we talking about? Who's come?
Cher Height.
Okay.
Cher Height. It's S-H-E-R-E-H-I-T-E.
Okay. And she was honestly, like, just beyond an icon for so many reasons. She was like, she did all these like crazy research.
Still laughing.
Still not over it.
Oh my God, Rob.
Carry on. Go on then. So, what is she
No,
doing?
I really love that we've had this moment. It's, so yeah, she was like, did all these researches where she basically studied like how much women were experiencing pleasure, and then she came out with this book and it was like all based on data, and she was completely vilified, and she would go on TV and say things like to all these like horrific men. If when you watch the documentary's coming out here soon, I think, and when you watch it, there are these, she's coming across like against these men who just think she's disgusting for even talking about sex, and she's sitting there talking about wanking like on live TV in the 70s, and these men are just, it was so inspiring. But then actually she had a really sad, like she basically got sort of like bullied out of America and ended up leaving, and it's really sad because, again, it was ahead of her time. They weren't ready for her.
It's so ridiculous as well, because it's essentially about pleasure and joy and like also something that is totally normal. And do you know what I mean? It's like everybody wants to do it, or not everybody wants to do it, but a lot of people want to do it. So it's like...
they want to come.
A lot of people want to come, Rob, right?
Yeah, they
want to
come.
Right, Rob?
What do they want to do?
They want to come. So let's get to our final question. So I take it for you, a museum isn't the perfect date. Seeing as you've been shushed by your ex in one and you fell asleep in another and you feel you have a panic attack.
I don't agree with that. I think dates and
I agree, but for Grace, I don't think it's...
for Grace. Because when we interviewed London Hughes, do you remember we spoke about...
Yeah, absolutely, but I think for Grace, it isn't a place where you're going to feel comfortable on a date.
I don't know. Maybe one day. Definitely not right now, because I'm absolutely... I hate dating. So
I want to hear about the 28 dates later, which is incredible social experiment. I love this. And you haven't had a date since.
I haven't been on a date since. I have obviously had sex obviously I have sex because I love having sex, but I have not intently dated to meet a man since that project, because it was almost like, you know, I don't know, like when I used to go on big benders and then afterwards I'd be like, I'm never drinking again. Going on 28 dates in such a short space of time. On one day I went on 4 dates, like genuine dates.
So it's been within a month. You had 28 dates in a month.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was honestly, well, it was some of them were then in May because I was on tour, but it was in a very short amount of time, and it was really fun and really interesting. So I went on dates with people I would have never usually gone on dates with, and I actually ended up dating someone from it who I met. He was in an open relationship, which like if before that project, I don't think I would have like gone on a date with someone who is in an open relationship, because like I didn't have a huge understanding of it, but then actually because I'm a bit of a commitment phobe at the moment, it was kind of perfect.
How did you find them all? Was there a rule for how you found them? Or
various different dating apps. Some were like people I'd been set up with, some were people I used to date. I slid into a few people's DMs. What else? I got introduced by like one person that I'd already been on a date with, and I was like, do you want to set me up with someone else? So it was kind of like random, but then a lot of them were on Field.
So what's Field is a dating app?
Field is a dating app, yeah.
And you haven't dated since because it was such a traumatic experience, or it just would feel like work now?
Record this?
Yeah. It's a podcast. Each date is an episode and then I talk about it. I think the latter, actually, which I've not quite realised, is because it felt like work. And I think it started to make dates feel like work. And I already felt a bit like that because I mine so much of my comedy from my personal life. And then it felt even more like going on a date feels like a job. And so maybe that's why I've been a bit averse to it.
This is the thing. I heard this, actually. I've heard some of them because you posted them the other day in stories.
Yes.
And then you asked, and you had that guy who went to Cambridge University or something.
Yeah, he went to Oxford.
That
he was horrific.
Oxford.
He was so
that was
horrific.
Just horrific.
I went on a date with this guy, Russell, and he was one of the worst people I've ever sat in front of, like ever. It's called The Walking Red Flag, that episode. And he was so offensive. And at one point he told me that he'd dressed up as a terrorist at a party. He was friends with all the Bullingdon boys from Oxford. And I sort of...
Which he called the bully boys, didn't he?
The bully boys. Awful. And I started saying to him, like, various reasons why that's, like, really inappropriate and not acceptable. And then he goes, whoa, you are getting so aggressive right now. You need to calm down. And I just, like, took the mic off and was like, I'm leaving. Like, goodbye. Thank God that this is just, like, not, like I could just leave.
But talking about sharing, I loved how you then opened it up to your DMs for your audience to come back with their like dating nightmares. And some of those stories were
honestly,
just like...
Honestly, it's so rough. It's so rough right now.
David. Why right now?
Minefield out there.
Well, I guess it's maybe always been rough, but some of the stories that I get told of people's single dating life now, especially with straight men, just some of their behavior is comical, but also it has this undertone of like Andrew Tate influence like, you know, not wanting a woman who's opinionated and is going to call them out on their bullshit. And, you know, like it's this thing that I keep noticing now. I watched Priscilla. Have you watched Priscilla?
No, not yet.
It was really interesting.
Jake Bellore, the Sofia Coppola movie.
Oh, he's so Sophia fucking Coppola. Fit.
Have you
it?
Got his bathwater as a candle yet?
That's art.
That is art. That is art.
Yeah. But that is like about Elvis and Priscilla, obviously. But it was really interesting on sort of how like powerful men, like a lot of them want like women who are much more submissive. And I think the things that women tell me now of their dating experiences, and definitely in my personal experience sometimes, not all the time, is that straight men are, some of them, not all of them, I know so many great straight men, but some of them are feeling maybe like they don't know where they stand with women in a dating capacity. So they act in a way that I don't know if it's intentional, but undermines the women that they are dating because they feel intimidated by their power or their confidence or the fact that these women don't need them anymore, you know?
Obviously stuff needs to change, but how can it change? How can this sort of, I guess, by you making the work that you're making, by your art?
I don't know. I think it's we have to raise future generations in a different way. And I think my generation was this, like, unfortunately, and then sort of now the internet generation, like the guinea pigs of this age of information and these influencers like Andrew Tate having the amount of influence that they do and being able to infiltrate people's minds in the way that they do. And so I honestly don't know. I really don't know. But it's one of the reasons I'm not dating, because I don't want to get stuck opposite someone like that ever again.
Mm. Yeah, I can understand that. I really feel like it's really important, a bit like what's happening. You know, you got your Tate membership for your friend. There's a really amazing show on at Tate Britain right now. It runs until the 7th of April called Women in Revolt. And it's looking at art and activism in the UK between 1970 and 1990. And it's just the most extraordinary group of artists. And just the message within that show, each and every artwork just, you know, has so much within it to inspire and uplift and to make people realize they have a voice. And I feel like even Sinead O'Connor's passing recently and Catherine Ferguson's documentary about Sinead's life, I feel like the more we highlight, and also the sheer height.
100%. Because the more we see how these women have been treated, it's such a reminder of why we have to be the way that we are. And like both Sinead O'Connor and Cher Height are women who were vilified for essentially having opinions that lots of people agreed with, and people were scared of that.
And with all the change in American law now, you know, taking away women's rights, you know, reproductive rights, all of these issues that are happening, and what you're talking about, the whole Andrew Tate effect, I also feel as a gay man, a complete responsibility and allyship for women to stand up, support women. And I don't just mean like in public, if you see someone being treated badly, obviously stand up in that situation if it's safe, you know, to do so, to protect other people. But I just feel like you have to highlight women basically and support women, because without women, we are fucked.
Do you feel a change at all as a woman in comedy?
definitely in terms of like opportunity and stuff. And if whenever I listen to like Catherine Ryan talking about what it was like when she started in the comedy in the UK, I'm like, God, it's again another person who had to go through, who had to plow through the shit so that like I didn't have to smell it when I was coming up. So it definitely is changing. But then I do also see this other side of, I guess, this influence that not just Andrew Tate, but that effect that's having on some men infiltrates into comedy. It's becoming much more polarized. Like you'll just have gigs for like women and queer people, and then you'll more have gigs for like straight men and I guess some women who don't mind gigging with some of those men. But there are lots of comedians that I wouldn't be bothered to perform with because I don't want to follow someone who's just made loads of like really off-key jokes about rape and just jarring shit for me to have to go on stage and be funny.
Have you seen the Mrs. Merton doc, Caroline Ahern doc, and they go into Mrs. Merton and how the opportunities she had at that point, she had, what's his name, Bernard Matthews come on, and he'd just basically said, I'm homophobic and I'm a racist. And she was just like, oh, come on, Bernard. And she was trying to like, and she absolutely annihilated him in a really kind of sweet old woman way. You've got to watch the documentary. It's incredible what she achieved at that point. And she had her platform and she invited him on. And he obviously was maybe unawares of what the actual platform was, but she did something incredible in that
really
moment.
Really? Oh, wow, amazing.
Yeah, you've got to watch it.
Because also he probably thought he would get away with it.
100%.
You know,
yeah.
It's that arrogance that some people have, thinking that they'll outsmart you.
Really, really brilliant about her life.
I loved
her. Craig Cash, like reminiscing and all about the royal family. And yeah, it's an amazing woman. What an amazing woman. I mean, incredible what she achieved. As you are doing, Grace. You're making
a difference. Well, guys, you're too nice. It's so nice.
No, you are. So we're going to get to our final questions now. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could steal any artwork from the government art collection. No, from anywhere in the world. From anywhere in the world. What would it be and why?
I was going to say something so dumb.
Go on. What?
I was going to say I want my childhood back from Tony Blair.
And Sherry, because your mum worked for Sherry.
Yeah,
Blair family.
Yeah, I want
Mr.
my childhood back. I was talking to Katie about what to say because I was like, I don't know what to say. Like I was like, I want to sound. But then we were talking about it, and she was like, "What was the first piece of art that you like remember thinking you loved?" And I was like, "In Gossip Girl." So I don't know if you guys are familiar with the work of
XOXO.
So Serena Vanderwoodson's mum like had the most amazing art in their house, and they had this it was that Prada Milano, you know, the Prada sign. It's by Elm Green
and Dragset.
They
created it in the desert. They created this boutique in the desert.
Oh really?
Yeah. So it's like in the middle of nowhere, in the middle
is
of the desert. Yeah. Is it Martha? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think it might be in Texas.
Because then it was also
reason.
In The Simpsons. Because then me and Katie were talking about it, and then they showed it in The Simpsons. So I would want to rob like Lily Vanderwoodson's whole house because she also had loads of cool shit. She had a Marilyn Minter. It was like a sparkly. So it was in Serena's bedroom. It was like an eye, like with lots of glitter. So I'd rob all of the Vanderwoodson's art. Is what I would do. Because then I could
iconic.
Also be in Gossip Girl.
That's a great response.
That's
a great answer.
We've never had that before.
Really?
And it is Prada Marfa, Russ.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a boutique.
And me and Anna, my best friend, when we were younger, like we obviously, because I've got this thing. Oh, it's annoying. You'll probably not have to have this in the podcast.
Go on.
Did you see my Dolce Vita?
Oh yeah, so you've got like street art. Is that Mr. Brainwash?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Yes, my mum got that for me.
That's nice.
And then I've got this as well by this amazing artist called. Oh, I'm gonna have to go and look at her name. I follow her on Instagram. She's amazing. I got that at the Affordable Art Fair. Sorry, I'm just now giving you a tour of my house.
Oh, because that's in North London.
Yes,
it's in Hampstead a lot, isn't
house.
It? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's called Marcelina Amelia. Amelia Marcelina is her Instagram.
What is it about that piece? What is it actually in
the
image?
So it's basically got all these books on it. So the one that she is holding, the girl says, I only want everything. And then it's about, like, some of them are about anxiety, how to stay sane, FOMO for dummies. It's just, it felt very me, and it's pink.
What is it, a painting or a screen printer?
It's a painting.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I once brought a guy home.
Rocky.
And he was looking at those two pieces. And he was like, but why do you have them? And I was like, well, I don't know, like the Dolce Vita just looks kind of like rich and like chic, you know? And I was like, he was like, but why? I was like, I don't know. I just think it looks nice. Like, and I was feeling really like stressed by it. But her one, I feel like it's about like anxiety and sort of like being a woman, being a nervous wreck.
But the Mr. Brainwash one, I think there's a kind of decorative element to his work that's quite joyous and fun, and it is glamorous
exactly.
and a bit cool.
And yeah, like, and there's no shame
enough.
In that. Like,
no, exactly. But also, everyone has different parts of their personality, and I think when you collect art, it's almost like revealing parts of yourself, because for you to actually connect to an object, there's a reason why. But you might, you know, you have all different, you know, parts of you, and that will be reflected in the art you live with.
Yeah, and also I think we shame people too much for like being a bit like superficial. Like sometimes you,
yeah,
you can
or frivolous
just, like,
or
want to buy
silly.
Some Prada shoes and like not want to be like shamed about the fact that you want to do that.
Yeah, or be a lead role in Gossip Girl.
Oh,
so
exactly.
Your next question is, what is your favorite color?
Is this like one of those things that you're then going to tell me about like my whole personality based on this answer? There is a personality test.
Yes.
To do that. My favourite colour is probably baby blue.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say pink.
No.
So did I, because there's a lot of pink around
there's
you.
There's a
your
lot,
microphone's
pink, lot
pink.
Of pink and green. Yeah, everything in my house is pink. When I was younger, I hated pink. I actually had a phobia of pink, and I used to go everywhere with hand sanitizer spray. And if anyone touched me with anything pink, I would spray wherever they touched me, because I had such a phobia of pink. I was such a weird child. It's crazy that I was like popular. Like, I was so odd. But so I had a phobia of pink, because I was such a tomboy. I had two brothers and I really, really like wanted to be them. And so I hated pink, and I loved baby blue, and everything I had was baby blue. At secondary school, my tag was baby blue. Like, we all had tags and my tag was baby blue, but spelled like B-A-Y-B-E-E and then B-L-U.
Oh, this is your graffiti
blue.
Tag? Like,
what, yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
you'd write this
yeah.
on underneath chairs and stuff?
I'd write it
so
on,
so you were
like,
a young graffiti street artist. We didn't get to that.
It wasn't until
no,
the art teacher went, you're not creative. And it's like, you could have been the next Banksy Campbell.
Baby blue.
baby Banksy.
Baby blue.
You still could.
But baby blue, yeah, baby blue is my favourite colour.
Great. What's the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Do you know what? I was trying to think about this, and I actually received some really good advice today. So I'm just going to say that, because it's really fresh in my mind. But I was talking to a producer about this script that I'm working on. And she said, because I said, you know, I'm writing about something that has very recently happened to me that was a very intense thing to go through. And it's quite raw and it's sort of coming out like quite fast. It feels like I'm literally bleeding it out at the moment. But she said it's so good to do that when you're in the eye of it, because what will happen is if you don't do it now, in 6 months you'll kind of be over it, and then you won't have like written it down in the way that you are now. And then at the end, when I was leaving, I said it's very overwhelming, because I feel like it's a lot that's going on in my head that I'm trying to write down. And she said, you just have to see it line by line, page by page, day by day, and you don't have to think of it really long term. You're just getting it out as you are now, and then you'll be able to look at it all as one big piece, because I've not written anything this complicated in my life. So it kind of feels like I could be having a breakdown.
Has that advice already changed your thought process on development?
It made me feel a lot better about, you know, because I've been really strict with myself this month of, I really want to write this piece that I'm writing. It's a script. And I've had to sort of say no to lots of stuff because I want to get it done now. But she really affirmed that thing that I felt, which is I should be writing it now, because I'm feeling so many emotions about it. And it would be a waste to not really like be writing it while I'm feeling all of this. Because you then suddenly do forget about things that have happened quite fast, you know?
I think that's just the human psyche, though, is that when you're in the eye of a storm, it feels terrible. And in retrospect, the pain doesn't feel as bad, because that's what the body does. It just recovers, and no feeling is finite. But actually, when you're in it, if you can use that trauma, as you know, we're lucky as artists that we can channel that into creativity. If you can in that moment do that, there's something really cathartic and really special in kind of using that.
It becomes
a privilege. Yeah. That trauma becomes a privilege.
And it's almost, I always say, it's like I like being able to offset my trauma because it makes me feel like it was worth something when I'm then making it into something that I hope will make other people feel better. I'm like, that's why that had to happen, because otherwise this wouldn't have happened.
100%.
And then it makes me feel more sort of comfortable about it, because I hate feeling angry about things. I hate having like anger towards people or situations or regret. So it's much better to just make it into something, because then you can be like, that's why it had to happen.
Well, I think for me, I find that creativity has been something like a gift, in the fact that it's given me the privilege of being able to put trauma somewhere. And you know, what other jobs do we have where I can go into a scene and I can cry and scream and everyone applauds you? Normally in any other regular job, you know, when I've got sort of using that trauma, you go to HR and you'd be struck off for a while. You know, it's like we're so lucky that creativity is a real outlet for all this stuff. And I also believe in, you know, what you're saying about the universe and things had to happen, is that pain happens to everybody. And this isn't just talking about creative people, because you have to move in life. You have to move somewhere. And sometimes the only way that you do is through a really painful experience, but it pushes you somewhere. And if you hadn't gone through that painful experience, you wouldn't be where you are now. So there's a privilege in these events and not having any regrets and realizing that things happen to get you to where you're meant to go if you believe in all of that, which I do.
I really do. And I think that when I was saying earlier how much I feel I've really grown up in the last year, a lot of it is that, is feeling I can process stuff in a much healthier way and not feel angry towards people and not feel bitter or resentful, because those are such unhealthy emotions. They're so bad for you and such a bad, toxic way to be carrying yourself around the world. And so, yeah, like, but we are so lucky, because for me to be able to say I'm going to take this month to write about something really traumatic that's just happened to me. You know, most people go through something really traumatic and they have to go back to work the next day and then, yeah, you know, act as though it never happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
You know, you did the podcast a few years ago with your dad, which was football, feminism and everything in between. And you guys brought feminism and football together. I wanted to give you a tip, which is that in the Tottenham Hotspur site, there's actually an art gallery now called OOF, OOF Gallery. And they have brought art and football together, and they do exhibitions on all kinds of topics, a lot to do with masculinity and even queerness, actually. Loads of amazing shows.
Oh my God, I love that.
And feminism, but with art. And I thought
Caroline Coon's work was in there, wasn't it?
Yeah, Caroline Coon's there. Yeah.
Oh, we went to Tottenham last week. I wish I'd known that. Me and my dad.
Oh, did you? Yeah, it's actually on the site. And they also have a magazine called OOF, which is a really brilliant magazine. And they do like cool artist editions where it's like football jerseys, like designed by an artist. Like, you would absolutely love it, I think. And your dad would too.
That's really cool. Okay, that's really cool. I'm definitely going to do that with my dad. I love that. And I also think football's changing so much. That's such a great example of how football is changing.
Well, there's your hot tip. This has been amazing to spend this time with you, Grace. Thank you so, so much for hanging out with Talk Arts with these two vulvas. We're so we've had such a nice time.
It was an honour and a privilege. Thank you for having me, truly.
And for everyone listening, what is your Instagram so they can follow you if they don't already know you?
Disgrace Campbell.
It's Disgrace Campbell.
And you can
get Grace's book, which is called Amazing Disgrace, and it's a book about shame, which you'll all probably relate to. So please buy that book. And also, who was the artist again that you collaborated
with? Alice Skinner. One of my best friends, and she did the artwork for my podcast as well. She's incredible. She's called This Is Alice Skinner on Instagram.
Amazing. Yeah, we love her. I really like her illustrations. They're great.
You have an upcoming tour. Grace Campbell is on Heat. That's all written though. You haven't got to write that. That's not written either.
That is not written.
Okay. Just write it on the night when
you're there. So far from written, but it is in October, so I'm going to vomit it out at some point soon.
Okay, amazing. Yeah. Well, we all look forward to that. But thank you very much for joining us. Thank you everyone for listening.
Grace Campbell, we love you. And
I love
everyone,
you.
We're going to post images and we'll be back very soon. And come stay, Grace, in Margate. I can't wait.
I would absolutely love that, truly.
I've got Kadeef Kerwan downstairs right now, but when he's moved out, you can move in.
I'd really love that.
We'll be back very soon.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.